Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. Today, we're tackling a topic often misunderstood and neglected, menopause and perimenopause. For many women, this natural stage of life, it's met with dismissal, misdiagnosis, and even outright denial of care, from mood swings and hot flashes to low libido and those relentless evenings of insomnia. These aren't just symptoms. They're critical health issues that deserve serious attention. Joining us today is Amy Alcon, author of Going Menopausal, and she's here to separate science from myth, challenge the misconceptions, and share how women can advocate for better health. This is a conversation that really every woman and anybody who out there that knows a woman and cares about them needs to hear. Stay tuned. It all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our guest today is award-winning investigative science writer and best-selling author of 5 books. She specializes in taking complex research, critically evaluating it, and then translating it into practical everyday language. For over 25 years, she's been empowering people to make scientifically informed decisions for their health and well-being. She's impacted the lives of millions with 2 TED Talks, served as president of the Applied Evolutionary Psychology Society, and is a certified mediator specializing in behavioral science-based conflict resolution. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, Time, the Washington Post, and on shows like Good Morning America, NPR, and the Joe Rogan Experience. Her new book is called Going Menopausal, What You and Your Doctor Need to Know About the Real Science of Menopause and Perimenopause. Welcome to the show, Amy Alcon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, like I mentioned before we started, the topic's very popular on the show, but you really bring a fresh perspective that changes the status quo. To kick things off, what inspired you to write Going Menopausal, and how did you come up with this brilliant title?
Thank you. Well, actually, I have had the generosity of Sandra Greenland, who's one of the top epidemiologists in the world and behind reforming methodological error and fraud in medical science. And so he has been informally coaching me in how to read science, how to critically evaluate it since about 2007. And so I had this ability, and because he had been communicating with me, we talk, and he would send me papers and articles about the fraud and error in medicine, and just the inability of doctors to understand the science. And so when I have a problem, I don't just go to the doctor. I read first, and then I go. And so I had a hot flash, and I read the science in perimenopause, which is the 3 to 10 year transition to menopause, which is wildly misunderstood by doctors. And I saw there was a huge gap between the practice standards in medicine and what the evidence said. And so that's where this all got started.
Yeah, I know so many doctors, they treat the menopause and perimenopause as if they're the same thing, but you strongly disagree. Can you explain why this distinction matters and how this leads to inadequate care?
So yeah, this is so important. Doctors and even researchers, which is terrible, believe that menopause and perimenopause are basically the same thing, the menoblob, I call this, and they are in fact hormonally very different stages. In perimenopause, the doctors believe that your estrogen level is just declining, like, you know, grains of sand in an hourglass. And then you get to menopause, it's really low. But in fact, in perimenopause, your estrogen level spikes and dives, which causes some horrible symptoms, especially if your body is not making estrogen's menstrual cycle partner hormone, progesterone. And what happens in perimenopause is that you'll have seemingly normal menstrual cycles. They seem like any other menstrual cycle. But because of the feedback issues that start to go on in your brain and your ovaries during perimenopause, you end up having cycles where you don't ovulate. And they just seem like normal cycles. But what this means is the egg in the little sac does not rupture. It stays there. It stays in its little sac, or you're weakly ovulatory. And this means that you're not making progesterone or enough progesterone because the litter left over from the ruptured sac called the corpus luteum is what progesterone is made out of. So no rupture, no litter, no progesterone. And this can make women very, very symptomatic and sick. And doctors don't know this. And this is such a problem because what helps you in perimenopause, if you're having these anovulatory cycles, these no ovulation cycles, is to take progesterone to fill in for the progesterone that is missing. And this is vitally important because it not only helps symptoms, especially insomnia, which is raging for many perimenopausal women, but it protects your breasts and endometrium, the uterine lining, from cancer.
Yeah, you and your book, you mentioned something I didn't realize. You say that most gynecology departments don't even have one doctor specifically trained in menopausal or perimenopausal care. And considering how common the stages are in life, that's pretty darn common. Why is there no adequate healthcare? Why is it so rare?
This is so terrible. I just want to comment a little bit on this. This is a scandal of gynecology departments. So doctors have no training or education in menopause. It's pretty much ignored in med school. Maybe doctors get a few days in a textbook or a lecture or two, but they're not going through clinical rotation with some mean, cranky old doctor who's kicking their butt on the errors they make in diagnosis or in understanding of the field. And so you've got all the doctors, basically, most of the doctors treating women have no idea. They have no training or expertise, which makes it a violation of medical ethics for them to treat you, but they do it anyway. There's nobody to treat you. And they'll say in some gynecology departments, oh, we've got a perimenopause and menopause expert. Now, what does this mean? This typically means that they have taken an online course at the Menopause Society. And I mean, this is not the same thing. This is, you know, California, we have traffic school. If you get a ticket, you'd take an online course, you pass, you get to keep your license and lesser fines. This is basically traffic school for your vagina and ovaries. And it does not equate with real expertise from doing serious reading in the science, which doctors are not equipped to do anyway, which is another big myth of our medical care.
Yeah, I love that you call it the most patient betraying areas in medicine. So that makes sense why, because it's so widely needed, but it's not like some rare disorder disease. Well, you probably won't see this, so just buzz over that, you know, the teacher telling the students. This is a big deal.
It absolutely is. Half the population is dealing with menopause and perimenopause at some point in their lives, and many are seriously symptomatic. And also, because we need estrogen and progesterone to protect us, these are important to take. Where estrogen has been demonized, unscientifically demonized, in the wake of the Women's Health Initiative study in 2002, which was discredited basically by 2004, that study where they had said, oh, healthy menopausal women are prone to increased cancer risk, Alzheimer's risk, all these horrible things. And in fact, they had not tested healthy menopausal women. They tested a large number of women who were elderly and very infirm, very sick, obese. They had all sorts of physical problems. And if you give estrogen to a woman who is physically broken, physically harmed already by injuries and unhealth, this makes her unhealthier. It harms her further. And so they harmed a lot of women, I believe, in this study. And so all these healthy women, they tossed out their estrogen prescriptions, and women became afraid to take estrogen, wrongly so. If, as a healthy woman who has just entered menopause, which is 12 months without a period, you take estrogen, this can protect you throughout your lifespan. You have to initiate it right at menopause or within. Usually it's 6 years is the safest, or 10 years at most, but you have to make sure you don't have plaque in your arteries already, because this is an important thing. You need to be healthy at that point for this to be healthy throughout your lifespan, and women are to be monitored. This is the science in the wake of the Women's Health Initiative study. You monitor the individual health of the woman and how she's doing, and it's important to take this for decades because, for example, you break bones not at age 65, but at age 79. And estrogen is highly protective for your bones, as is progesterone, the estrogen's partner hormone. And you want to be taking it at 79 to protect you when you might break a bone. And if you stop it at, say, 60, which is the old thing they used to say, taper off estrogen at 60, then you not only reverse the advances in your bones from estrogen, you are left utterly unprotected at the time you are likely to fracture.
Yeah, good points. I know. Talk to us about all this confusion around hormone replacement therapy, from synthetic hormones, bioidentical options, and even the natural remedies like black cohosh and evening primrose oil. And there's so many things that are offered. Can you break down anything that you found, that the science behind it, and maybe help us understand what's effective and safe for women in perimenopause and menopause?
Absolutely. Now, this is from the research of Geraldine Pryor, MD. She's an endocrinologist, researcher, and clinician from UBC. She's excellent. And the research on progesterone and perimenopause in the book is largely from her and her colleagues. Really important stuff, largely dismissed by the rest of the menopause science area, which is really wrong. And really, it's very important to look at her stuff. So progesterone is the hormone that goes missing in perimenopause. Doctors will give women estrogen. Now, if your estrogen level is spiking and diving, as it is in many people, and you're not making progesterone, this is like being given a drug overdose. Even though estrogen is a healthy and important hormone in our bodies, if you're already sick because your estrogen is skyrocketing, you don't want more. And what you need is to know if you are not ovulating, not making progesterone, and then have that instead, because that's what goes missing. And so the way you do that, I have in the book, this is also from Geraldine Pryor. They put this together, she and her colleagues, quantitative basal temperature taking. This is different than the BBT, those apps, which are all wrong because they're based on a 28-day menstrual cycle, which actually is not the case. Science has shown that to be wrong. So you take your temperature every morning for a month and ideally for a few months, and you see if you have the temperature rise for the adequate number of days that says you are making progesterone, you're ovulating and making progesterone in adequate supply. And if you're not, you are likely not sleeping, having horrible hot flashes, having horrible brain fog because you're not sleeping, as well as other symptoms, including mental health symptoms. Women have these horrible, inexplicable rages. I had this. And you feel so ashamed. I'm from the Midwest. I'm a nice person. And I was in a hardware store and a man was humming and I wanted to bludgeon him to death with some kind of heavy object. He looked around, he was like my dad or my grandpa fixing things in the basement. I would normally look around and be fond of him just by seeing that he was that kind of guy. But I really was so just wired and angry all the time. And progesterone, this is like this savior for all these symptoms. And doctors don't know that. And now, because doctors are so ignorant of perimenopause and menopause treatments, of the physiology of these stages, women take to the internet and try to help each other. And this is problematic because you see women recommending progesterone creams. These are not FDA approved. And this is, the FDA is not a panacea for things being right, I should say, before we get into this. But what that means is they're not regulated. So they can contain anything. The supplement area is the wild, wild west. And very importantly, progesterone creams do not contain enough progesterone in the right consistent amounts to protect your breasts from cancer and your endometrium. And the way progesterone does that, in your breast, for example, progesterone causes these generic cells that can go horribly delinquent to specialize, to differentiate into breast cells. So this way they have a job to do, so they can't do the crazy doubling that turns into cancer. And also same in the endometrium, estrogen causes proliferation and progesterone wrangles that. So you really need to have this FDA approved oral micronized progesterone, not medroxyprogesterone acetate, the synthetic, which doctors think is the same, and even researchers do. It's a massive error in the field. And now I know this because I'm a medical outsider. I'm an informed, able to evaluate research, informed medical outsider who looked at all of this, and I have an ability to see what doctors don't, who are trained in med school. They have a level of expertise, so they believe they're experts and don't check the sort of things I do because I'm terrified of harming women and I need to make sure that I understand the physiology from the get-go, where doctors already, you know, we saw that. We know what the genitourinary system looks like. That's your pelvis and your bladder and your vagina and cervix, all of that. And so this is vitally, vitally important. And then in menopause, taking estrogen is healthy and helpful, but you want to take transdermal estrogen. This is skin patch estrogen. It's like a sticker you put on because it is much safer than oral estradiol. Estradiol estrogen is a sort of class name, and this is the specific term for the estrogen that is the same as the estrogen in your body, estradiol. And progesterone is the same as the progesterone in your body, while medroxyprogesterone acetate, the synthetic that was on my provider, Kaiser Permanente's formulary, that it's a drug you don't want to take. It binds with the wrong receptor in the breast, the stress hormone receptor, and then it also is bad for the brain and bad for the cardiovascular system. So yeah, these are big problems.
Yeah, I know the number one problem that I hear from women in their 40s and beyond is the terrible sleep struggles they face during this stage of life. Have you discovered anything that can help females combat that hormonal sleep nightmare? Is progesterone one? I've heard some good things about that.
Oh, yes. That's what I was saying. Oral micronized progesterone, but you need to take 300 milligrams, which is not the amount they give in the U.S. Oral micronized progesterone, 300 milligrams taken at bedtime. This helps sleep in this incredible way. This is what goes missing, and you need that. And doctors here in America, they will prescribe 100 milligrams or 200. Why? For no reason. It's just clinical habit, and this is terrible. It's not like they tested it against 300 and said, oh, this is much better. And they have given 300 milligrams in France since 1980. This is very safe. Progesterone has fewer side effects than aspirin. And the women who can't take it, if you have very low blood pressure, it might be problematic because it lowers blood pressure a little bit. And then also if you have something called liver ascites, which is fluid in your liver, you know, but most women can take progesterone very successfully. It's this menstrual cycle hormone, and it goes up to 10 times the amount in a period during pregnancy. So this is not something that's killing women. Women don't die in pregnancy from the elevated progesterone in their bodies.
They don't. So that would help with insomnia and hot flashes. That's your big go-to?
This is the drug that helps. It's what's missing. So you fill in what's missing. I'm very conservative about taking drugs. All drugs have side effects, and you want to be sure that you're only taking as much as you need. But the reason for taking 300 milligrams that doctors in this country do not know, researchers don't know, is that you don't know what your level of steroid metabolism is. And progesterone and estrogen are steroids, steroid hormones. And so if you take less than 300 milligrams, you might not be getting sufficient protection for your breasts and endometrium. And many women, it seems, can't sleep as well on lesser doses. The 300 milligram dose seems to be very good. And in fact, some women could take more. It's not unhealthy. They just won't give it to you here in this country. So you may have to, women may have to seek out a telemed provider to get the extra amount and just not put it on their insurance, which is really, I mean, how crazy is that?
Yeah, that's awful. I know. Well, talk to us about this conflicting diet advice I hear. One expert will say, avoid soy. It's bad. It's got the hormone disrupt. Others say, eat more soy. It's better. Some say, skip meat and flax seeds, and even chickpeas are off limits now. And what's your perspective? What foods make a difference in managing symptoms? And is there any that you can recommend that they should avoid or maybe even add?
Well, I want to just explain nutrition research first, which is that this is like the most ridiculous research. Nutrition research, the way most of it operates is they ask people what they ate. Did you have a donut? Oh, no, no donuts. That was broccoli. You know, and people don't remember. And so this is why there's such conflicting research. The Mediterranean diet, no, eat a vegetarian diet. And what I did and what I do is I reverse engineer from what happens in our cells, the desired reactions in our cells, and what seems to cause heart disease, which is not the lipid hypothesis, the idea of cholesterol causing it. In fact, it seems to be high blood sugar and insulin resistance, which is a reaction of the constant need by your pancreas to bring down the blood sugar. Eventually, for many people, there's a broken insulin response. And this is what leads to high blood pressure and all the metabolic health problems like diabetes and kidney disease. And so the healthiest diet to eat, the healthiest is to eat a low carbohydrate, high fat diet with adequate protein. The government tells us adequate protein is 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. And there are these converters. You can look up grams to kilograms and look up your weight. And that is wrong. It's at least 1.2 grams of protein per kilograms of body weight. So if a woman weighs like 135 pounds, 140 pounds, it might be like 78 or 75. I'm just guessing here, just for, sort of from memory. But this is far less than most women get. And it's hard for vegetarians to get this. And they don't also eat protein that is metabolized very well by our system, where meat is actually in perfect supply of amino acids and the nutrients we need. And so a very healthy diet is what I actually eat to cut inflammation totally, which is a carnivore diet. So I eat a lot of fish and then I eat meat. The two things that's very important because it keeps inflammation low in my system. And inflammation is a big cause of the health problems as we age. And so it's important to keep that down because you get less robust. Your immune system is less robust and you want to foster the healthiest immune system and the healthiest mitochondria, which are energy providers in our cells. You want to foster that as you age, especially.
Yeah, I know a common complaint I hear from women over 40 is they used to enjoy a glass of wine without any issues, but once they hit menopause, hot flashes, burning feet, even nausea. What's your take on wine during this stage of life? Is it something that women should avoid altogether, or can it be enjoyed maybe in moderation?
Well, okay, I loved a glass of bitey white wine. I would drink a glass every night. And I stopped because I found that it gave me brain fog in the mornings. I needed to be able to write. And so wine, it's best if you just drink a whole lot less wine. I've started doing that. I drink wine maybe once every 3 months at a party. And I love wine, but I'm healthier without it. And so this is one of the things where it's a choice. Do you want to do this? Your sleep will be better. And you just become so much less robust that the things you could do when you were younger, just your body's not going to amortize the stuff you take in the same ways. And so if you want to just not feel terrible, probably not drinking wine very much is a good idea.
Yeah, because I know estrogen helps regulate blood vessels and body temperatures. So when estrogen levels drop, guess what? Alcohol can trigger or worsen those hot flashes and night sweats. And it's a vasodilator. So that brings that burning to the feet. So it's sad because us men, we could still enjoy wine. We don't have to cut back in 40s or 50s. I feel sorry for you.
Well, you're bringing up an important point. Estrogen is so protective of our cardiovascular system in menopause. And the reason why women's cardiovascular disease catches up to men's in menopause is that women stop having estrogen in their bodies. And so that was very important to me to take estrogen to protect my cardiovascular system. Once you stop taking it, the estrogen receptors in your endothelium, your arterial lining, they disappear. And you want to have those there because then estrogen can act in there. You want to be taking estrogen if you can, if that's possible. It's very, very important. And this is some of the health harm caused by the fraudulently announced Women's Health Initiative study with a terrible methodology where they tested estrogen on old women and were infirm and announced it as if it affected all women, including healthy women, which just does not.
Right. What about the dreaded drop in libido as females get older? Are there any evidence-based strategies, maybe hormonal, psychological, or even lifestyle related that can help reignite intimacy and improve sexual well-being?
There's an interesting part of this, which is first, to be very healthy, the more you have this overall bodily health, the better off you are. And estrogen is a part of this too. And I have to say, I sound like estrogen's my personal mission in life. I was afraid to take estrogen. I was very young when the Women's Health Initiative study was announced as in not close to menopause. And so I just heard it tangentially and I just thought, oh my God, estrogen is Satan. I'm never taking it. Well, I'm writing this book and it's not scientific to have that view. So I read the research and I thought, oh my God, this is really necessary. And so estrogen does a lot of very important things in your vaginal tissue and your whole pelvic area in terms of protecting your bladder. It helps you have the moisture in your vagina where you can have sex without it being horribly painful. And so this is the pain causes a lot of women to not want to have sex. And there's also something very interesting that isn't about menopause, which is the female cycle of sexual desire. And so we tend to believe that women's desire in relationships is the same as men's. Men's just, they just want to have sex just because, you know, there's no reason. And so women, once they're in a relationship, the spontaneous desire that they had when they were just dating the person at the beginning, that goes away. But that doesn't mean women are broken sexually. What women are, and this is from the research of Rosemary Bass and another at UBC, terrific psychiatrist, sexual medicine practitioner, she figured out that the female cycle of sexual desire is different, that women first need arousal and then they're wanting to have sex. The arousal doesn't just arise out of nowhere. They have to start making out with their partner. Something needs to trigger that. So it's triggerable. Arousal is triggerable. And so that's an important part where couples end up breaking up because it seems a woman doesn't want sex. And it's just because we're expecting something in a way it doesn't happen. And their testosterone is given for something called HSDD. It's hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And whether that actually helps, it may or may not. Testosterone, I put in the book when I was writing it that we didn't have the longitudinal research on cardiovascular disease and breast cancer. And now starting, I think, in 2022, we're seeing that it seems safe per breast cancer. Cardiovascular disease, we could have more research on that. But the women who have low free testosterone, the problem is that they can be prescribed testosterone, but the FDA has not approved any prescriptions. So women will have to get compounded testosterone through a compounding pharmacy, which is expensive, because you can't just take male testosterone, the prescriptions for men. Now, my provider, I just called about this, Kaiser Permanente, huge medical provider. When a woman needs testosterone, they give her Androgel for men. Now, this is a packet that comes in a huge dose because men take a big dose compared to us. This is terrible. So the woman's expected to somehow scoop out the minuscule dose that women are supposed to have adequately, the exact dose. How will you even do that? Plus, Androgel is designed for male skin. Male skin is 20 to 25% thicker than female skin, and men have more sebum, oil. So this is not going to be metabolized in female skin the same way it is in male skin. This is really horrible and harmful.
Yeah, I know a lot of females probably hearing talk about arousal and needing help, and they're thinking, wine used to do that for me. Now it's off limits. So they're like, it's a catch-22 because now it makes them feel crappy and it's hot, and the hot stroke gives them some people headaches as well. So yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. What about the dreaded, I call it mental pause, that frustrating lack of focus and mental clarity? What's behind that? And are there any strategies that can help improve concentration and maybe clear up the fog?
Well, first of all, sleep is very important. Sleep hygiene, anything you can do to help your sleep. Women in menopause tend to have more problems sleeping than they did in perimenopause, and progesterone does not necessarily work the way it did. This happened to me, and I ended up having to take a sleep drug. And sleep drugs, they really are not a thing you want to take. But I ended up getting this. The one evidence-based doctor I have is my psychiatrist. We did all these tests of what worked. And then I ended up taking trazodone, which is an anti-anxiety drug off-label for sleep. And Matthew Walker, who is a sleep scientist I respect, this is the one drug he speaks positively about. It's rather amazing. I quote him in the book about this. And so this is something that may be a necessity because you must have your sleep to be healthy. But there's a problem also that's not addressed. And estrogen in menopause, your dopamine and norepinephrine decrease. Now, I have attention deficit disorder, or I've been diagnosed with it. You have to be diagnosed with a disorder and get a drug. I think my brain is fantastic. I just have some challenges about organization. And so in menopause, my already low dopamine and norepinephrine tanked further because of menopause. And I really was just having huge cognitive issues. And so, for example, I'm in a meetup group and we count off. This is how bad they were. We'll count off to go into groups to debate our reading of the week. One, two, three, one, two, three. And as soon as I said my number, I would have to ask the guy next to me what his number was because I would forget. That's how terrible my memory was. Now, maybe mine's worse because of the ADD. But then another funny story from this is that I told the guy who heads our meetup, I said, I think my memory will be better after Tuesday because I'm going to start estrogen. And he said, that's the fifth time you told me that tonight. So, yeah.
I always say I have a photographic memory. I'm just out of film.
I like that. Yeah, that's definitely. And so estrogen really, an adequate dose seems to help with this. It has documented positive effects on the brain. There's wonderful research on this and by Rebecca Diaz-Brinton and others showing that if you take estrogen within like a short time after menopause, you want to do that before you start to have health problems within six years, ideally, or 10 years at most. But if you miss that, say that, you know, it's 11 years. If you're a healthy woman, I offer, there are all these tests in the book to see whether you're healthy enough to take estrogen. So this is not the ironclad cutoff. It's about being healthy when you initiate estrogen.
So true. I know I've had a lot of patients benefit from lion's mane, mushroom, and magnesium L-threonate and L-theanine. So there's other things they can try as well.
Yes.
What's neat about that magnesium actually passes the blood-brain barrier, so it improves memory, learning, and overall cognition versus the other types of magnesium. So not all magnesium is the same.
I love that you said this. Now, it's more expensive, so some women may not be able to take that, but threonate is the one kind, as you said, passes the blood-brain barrier, and it is so important for overall health. This is the thing I focus on in the book, that you need to have all of these essentials, like eating adequate protein, 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight at least, magnesium. You need to have your vitamin D level tested and make sure you're getting adequate vitamin D, and then vitamin K. Vitamin K is essential. So magnesium, K, and D work together to potentiate bone health. And calcium, this is such a horrible myth. Women are told to take this huge amount of calcium, which is really unhealthy and very likely not necessary. If you look at ancestral health studies by this guy, Mel Konner and others, and then also there's research, Walter Willett at Harvard. I have some problems with his research. The guy hates meat. But this seems to be supported that we need far less magnesium. Maybe we need like 500 to 700 milligrams, which you get through your diet. And the magnesium, these big boluses of magnesium we take in pills, these can cause a heart attack. And so this is some of the medical myth that goes on that's horrible. And I want to also say that healthy kidneys filter approximately 2,000 to 2,400 milligrams of magnesium a day. So if you have an impaired kidney or liver function, you need to get your doctor's okay before taking really magnesium or anything. But magnesium is very healthy. And if you just take as much as you need till you get diarrhea and then pull back, that should be a good amount. And the amount, the RDA for magnesium, it's 320 milligrams, but that seems very likely to be quite low. Oh, and one other thing, the amount listed on bottles of magnesium, this is not the amount you're getting. This is called elemental magnesium. You look at the percentage of the RDA, there'll be some percent that's listed on there. And you have to use that to figure out how much would be 100% of the RDA. It's very complicated and irritating.
Yeah, that's important. And so you kind of told us how the healthcare system's just gone to pot. What would you do to redesign it? What would that look like if you could make changes and finally create a system that truly meets women's needs? What would take place?
I offer this in the book in chapter 2. We have three big myths of medical care, and it is that doctors practice medicine according to evidence, that doctors are trained in diagnostic reasoning, like Dr. House, if anyone watched that show, and that doctors can correctly assess medical risk. So medical education needs to change. So doctors are taught how to read and critically evaluate research. They're not. Your doctor probably cannot read a scientific study and correctly appraise it. Doctors are not trained in diagnostic reasoning in med school. It's the most amazing thing. So this is the kind of reasoning you need to get to the underlying condition that's leading to symptoms, because symptoms can relate to a number of different diseases. And you want to know what's the underlying condition, because treating a symptom, you may be masking something, a disease. Like, let's say the person has headaches. Is it stress or do they have a brain tumor? If you make the headaches go away with medication, you're killing an important signal that is telling you, hey, the patient needs some treatment for cancer. And then the risk level, doctors cannot assess your risk from taking a drug or treatment or the benefit. They're not trained in how to do this, and it's not that hard. But these things need to be changed. But medical schools, no one really knows this, so they just do what they've been doing, and medical institutions don't fill in for these lacks. And they need to have people like teams who are experts in certain drugs to supplement doctors who can't be experts in everything. Like, say, doctors doing cornea transplants. They give steroids, they give steroid prescriptions and antibiotics. And these doctors tend to know absolutely nothing about the immune system and inflammation and steroids. And so you have a doctor, for example, this is an actual case, who in her field, the clinical habit is to prescribe 4 doses of this prednisolone acetate steroid that actually has systemic effects. It harms your bones, increases insulin resistance, and can lead to pressure that causes glaucoma in your eye over a period of years. Now, this doctor thinks, and when I say clinical habit, there isn't a test saying, oh, we should give this amount because it's better than that amount we tested. This is just what they do because they do it. So she thinks if 4 is good, eight is better. Well, that doesn't work that way. You can give patients horrible steroid overdoses that damage their adrenal system and their ability to produce healthy cortisol for a lifetime. It's really terrible. And so this doctor, she's sticking an X-Acto in your eye. You want her to be really focused on that. And so they should have teams that have this deep knowledge of steroids and prescribing those medications and of the antibiotics, where Kaiser Permanente, my provider, they give people with serious eye disease, with corneal transplants, they give them antibiotics that have back preservatives. Now, these begin destroying, eroding the corneal epithelium in a matter of days. And you can just take another one, another drug that doesn't have the preservatives. But that's not what they give because they don't know. The doctors are ignorant of the drugs. And this is such a factor across medicine. And the institutions, they'll say, oh, we have panels to know what the science is. But they tend to just rubber stamp what they've already done.
Yeah, well said. And the minute we have left, anything else you'd like to add that we didn't cover today?
Oh, yes.
Such a great topic.
Thank you. There are two things women need to do to be healthy throughout their lifespan. And I talk about estrogen and progesterone, but the two essential things are to eat a low-carb, low-inflammation diet and to do weight-bearing exercise that is called slow-speed weight training, where you lift, you do like 10 reps a day with weights that are very heavy for you, where you go 5 seconds up, 5 seconds down until muscle failure. That's where you can't do another lift with good form. And these two things, they actually affect your metabolism and your lifetime health and preserve both in a way, really, you don't want to medicate with drugs. This is medicating with lifestyle, and it's the essential way to live.
Fantastic. I want to thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure many of the listeners jotted down some notes, but you know what? That wasn't necessary because everything we discussed and more, it's in Amy's fantastic book. It's called Going Menopausal, What You and Your Doctor Need to Know About the Real Science of Menopause and Perimenopause. It's available wherever books are sold, or you can visit amyalcon.net. And while there, check out her TED Talks and other great resources she has available. You can follow Amy on X at Amy Alcon and on Instagram at Amy Alcon Bookstagram. And you can follow me on Facebook and X at Dr. David Friedman. And on Instagram, I'm at Dr. D. Friedman. If Amy shared something today that somebody you know needs to hear, send them a link to this episode of To Your Good Health Radio at toyourgoodhealthradio.com. And while there, browse our podcast library and share these favorite segments out there that you see, guests you love, topics, send them to friends, family, coworkers. The information is too important to keep to yourself. As I always say, sharing is caring. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on Apple, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. More great conversations are on the way. Stay tuned and stay well.